It's Friday, March 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. declares Islamic State has committed genocide. China renews relations with an African nation, no longer recognizing Taiwan.
It is the Cuban people who should and who will decide their future, and the United States will not be making demands on anyone in Cuba.
President Obama is about to make an historic visit to Cuba. Also ahead, a new policy for killer whales. And a music classic still enjoyed after more than four decades. It's all on today's International Edition. The top U.S. diplomat has declared that the Islamic State is committing genocide against Christians, Yazidis, and Shiite Muslims under its control in Syria and Iraq.
My purpose in appearing before you today is to assert that in my judgment, Daesh is responsible for genocide against groups in areas under its control, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shia Muslims. Daesh is genocidal by self-proclamation, by ideology, and by actions in what it says, what it believes, and what it does. Daesh is also responsible for crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing directed at these same groups, and in some cases also against Sunni Muslims, Kurds, and other minorities.
Secretary of State John Kerry, who made the declaration Thursday, meeting a deadline set last year by Congress for him to determine whether the Islamic State's targeting of minority groups could be defined as genocide. International Edition's Susan Yockey discussed Kerry's move with Joe Stork of Human Rights Watch's Middle East Division. She asked Stork, who is in Baghdad, what he thinks of the U.S. declaration.
Well, I'm not sure what the circumstances are surrounding it, why Mr. Kerry made this announcement at this time. Usually there's a political agenda here, and I'm not quite sure what it is. I mean, look, we, certainly our organization, have documented crimes of ISIS that certainly amount to crimes against humanity. I mean, you know, genocide it really depends on the factual findings of a situation. It's not a situation we've investigated per se, and so I'm not going to make that make that call in response to a press call like this. But I think certainly we're looking at an organization that certainly is responsible for very serious crimes. It's a good example of why the United States should be supporting the calls we have made for Iraq to join the International Criminal Court, precisely so that groups like Islamic State could be prosecuted international for these kinds of crimes.
Joe, could you please share with us some of the cases that you're familiar with where ISIS has committed these crimes?
Well, look, we're talking about systematic executions. I mean, I could mention the famous Camp Spiker killings, where upwards of 1,700 young Iraqi Shia military recruits were assassinated in cold blood back in June of 2014. I can refer to the killings, systematic killings of particularly a Yazidi community up in the Sinjar area in northwestern Iraq, the enslavement of Yazidi women. I mean, just to mention a few, the executions of journalists and aid workers, including Americans and other non-Iraqis.
If this is taken to court, it could take a very long time before it's resolved, before anybody's actually brought to trial. Is there anything that can be done in the meantime?
Well, I think this is a situation where you want to be prosecuting people. First of all, to uncover the truth of the matter, to bring some satisfaction to the victims that the international community is paying attention to the situation. Secondly, to bring some sort of justice, in other words, hold the people responsible, accountable. That's the main reason.
Joe Stork of Human Rights Watch. Turning to our social media segment, G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with online reaction to our top story. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What do we have on Secretary Kerry's remark on Twitter?
Secretary Kerry sent out four tweets about Daesh Thursday, and here are the first two. It is my judgment that Hashtag Daesh is responsible for genocide against groups in areas it controls, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shia. In another tweet he wrote, Hashtag Daesh is also responsible for crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing directed at these groups, as well as Sunnis, Kurds, and other minorities.
What's the public reaction like?
For that, I went to the State Department's Twitter page at StateDPT. He shared a clip of him making the remarks, and a lot of comments to that tweet were quite sarcastic. They mostly implied Kerry and his department are late to the game. One of the most liked comments reads like this, and in other less obvious news, water is wet, the sun rises daily.
Well, perhaps obvious to some, but still important to point it out publicly. What else is trending online today?
North Korea sentencing an American college student to 15 years of hard labor is still trending. The State Department on Twitter shared a video of Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner commenting on the conviction of Otto Warmbier and urging Pyongyang to pardon him. Some of the replies asked for a ban on leisure travel to the communist country.
I see. So we also have a report on SeaWorld and its orca breeding program later in the show. Do we have anything on that?
A lot, actually. The U.S. Entertainment Park announced a decision to stop the breeding of orcas on Facebook and shared a link for more information at seaworldcares.com/future. The mammals are also known as killer whales. Jim?
Well, thank you for the analysis, G. You may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. My Twitter handle is at VOA Stevenson. And we also invite you to follow the International Edition stream. That's found at VOA_IE. China on Thursday resumed ties with former Taiwan ally Gambia, and that ended an unofficial diplomatic truce between China and Taiwan following January's landslide election of the leader of a pro-independence party as the self-ruled island's president. The small West African state was one of a few African countries to recognize Taiwan, which China regards as a wayward province to be recovered by force if necessary. Gambia severed relations with Taiwan almost 3 years ago, but China held off establishing its formal ties with the African nation until now. VOA Steve Miller explores the move with Jonathan Miller, no relation, but he is a fellow on East Asia for the East-West Institute.
It's an interesting move by China, especially if you take it into context of the recent election in January, the landslide election of the of what they see as a pro-independence party, Tsai Ing-wen. I think that looking at this in context, from 2008 onwards until now, there was kind of an informal truce between the Chinese and Taiwan on not kind of interfering on this kind of battle between which states would give diplomatic recognition. So this really seems to be somewhat of a provocative move diplomatically for China to kind of break with that. And I can't help but think that the new leadership in Taipei is one of the reasons why China has seemingly taken this. But I think it's important to note as well that in Gambia's case, that they did actually, as you noted, sever ties in 2013. So it's not that this decision was severing ties and then engaging in diplomatic ties with China, but basically it was taking that next step to formalize diplomatic relations with the PRC.
Well, China has previously requested that President-elect Tsai say that she's not going to move forward with independence. Do you think this is some sort of move, in your opinion, to exert more pressure to ensure that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that after her election in January, and I mean, she'll be assuming office in May, I think there's been a lot of kind of, concern in China about whether she actually will maintain the status quo. It's important to note that she has mentioned, through her campaign and afterwards, after her election, that she does plan to maintain the status quo, the cross-strait status quo. We know the landmark meeting that happened between President Ma and Xi Jinping before the election. That obviously exerted some pressure on the new government as well. So I think that she has no intention of massively changing the status quo, but she also has her own pressures from, obviously, the DPP, her party, which traditionally has been more of a pro-independence party. So she's going to have to balance her own pressures with the pressures from China. And I think that Beijing is tightening the screws even a little bit more with moves like this.
Taiwan's foreign ministry said that they will continue to be vigilant and pay close attention to China's pressure on the international scene to safeguard their interests. Now, with only a handful of countries formally recognizing Taiwan, is there cause for concern in Taipei of waning international recognition?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, the countries that Taiwan has established diplomatic relations with is dwindling, and it's still a small number, and the profile of those states is nothing compared to the states, obviously, that recognize China. I mean, to give you an example of a few of them, we have Nauru and Palau in the Pacific. You have the Vatican City. You know, you don't have a whole lot of these big states that are pledging to recognize Taiwan. And a lot of that is those smaller states have been wooed due to financial aid and different other concessions that the Taiwanese have made. So I definitely think that, especially in Africa, with there only being a few countries left that currently recognize Taiwan, that there's going to be more and more pressure on the African states to recognize ties with China, especially considering its footprint in that continent.
Jonathan Miller, fellow on East Asia for the East-West Institute. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Obama makes history Sunday when he arrives on the communist-ruled island nation of Cuba. It's the first visit to Cuba by a sitting U.S. president in nearly 90 years. The Obama administration official said Wednesday Mr. Obama will hold bilateral talks with his Cuban counterpart, Raul Castro, Monday, and then meet with members of Cuban civil society, including human rights activists, and address the Cuban people on Tuesday. Ted Henkin, who will be in Cuba during the president's visit, has written extensively about Cuba and is an analyst at Baruch College in New York. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Obama visit is aimed at making the normalizing of relations begun in December 2014 irreversible. He also sees it as an opportunity to speak directly to the Cuban people.
While it is true that the Cuban government has been very resistant to responding in a reciprocal manner to the United States' gestures and opening, I think that the Obama administration knew that, and they want to make this trip really to communicate with the Cuban people to remove the United States from the scene as the bete noire, the whipping boy, the scapegoat for all of Cuba's problems, and really communicate directly to the people that our policy is really built around empowerment, prosperity, not poverty, engagement, not isolation. And while we will and we are making diplomatic connections and strides with the government, we also intend to continue to respectfully and diplomatically but forcefully stand up for American values of human rights, democracy. But the president has made very clear at the same time that it is the Cuban people who should and who will decide their future, and the United States will not be making demands on anyone in Cuba, but will be communicating a message of friendship, of assistance, of solidarity, and also making clear that the policy of the past failed, and we are beginning a new path.
Will he be able to meet dissidents?
Yes, absolutely. And the Obama administration has been clear repeatedly that if Obama goes to Cuba, part of the deal is that he gets to talk with everybody, with who he chooses and not who the government wants him to meet with only.
Human Rights Watch has called on the president to call for concrete measures to end systemic repression in Cuba during this visit.
The strategy that has developed under Raul since he took over from Fidel roughly 10 years ago is that instead of typically sending people to prison for long terms for political crimes, people have been harassed, they've been detained systematically, and the numbers of detentions run around 8,000 detentions, short-term detentions a year. This is combined with attacks, mob attacks, beatings, harassment. So that's one of the things that they're pointing to. But also there's a whole gamut of fundamental freedoms, such as the freedom of assembly, the freedom of the press, that effectively don't exist in Cuba, although the Cuban people, in various guises, have been making great efforts to occupy new spaces over the last 5 years, and especially over the last year and 2 months. Given that the tension with the United States is waning, I think that people want to take advantage of the space of lowered tension so that it's not so easy to dismiss them as lackeys of a foreign power, as being controlled, as mercenaries, but as citizens who have diverse and often dissenting opinions that they want to share through the press, independent organizations, associations.
Ted Henkin says he sees the trip as both significant and symbolic in legitimizing an independent civil society in Cuba that is not necessarily opposed to the government but provides a credible alternative voice. After Cuba, Mr. Obama will travel to Argentina, the first bilateral visit in nearly 20 years. It's part of an ambitious year of travel throughout the Americas, taking the president to Canada for a North American Leadership Summit, and then to Peru for November's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. The U.S. theme park operator SeaWorld said it's ending its controversial killer whale breeding program. The company said Thursday that the whales currently at its parks would be the last. The Florida-based SeaWorld Entertainment Incorporated, which has parks in California and Texas, said it would replace its signature Shamu killer whale theatrical shows with displays focusing on conservation. SeaWorld also announced a partnership with Humane Society, saying the agreement will help each group extend its mission of preserving and protecting wild animals and the places they live. Nicole Paquette with the Humane Society describes the SeaWorld partnership that seemed unlikely for years.
Our two organizations have long been adversaries, and we are excited now to see that the company is transforming its operations for the better on animal welfare. And through its decision today to prohibit future breeding of orcas, given the growing public sentiment and just issues around more people being aware of the life of an orca, I mean, I think the SeaWorld really did listen to public sentiment and took a proactive step today in officially ending orcas for the long haul in captivity.
The controversy does not seem to be over yet. The Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals is contesting the use of the pens at SeaWorld for the orcas, hoping that perhaps this may change to some more form of an ocean type of enclosure.
Yes. One additional commitment that SeaWorld has made is to change its theatrical performances as well to of more of a natural style showing and demonstrating enrichment and exercise behavior. And so I think that will definitely be much better, obviously, than these theatrical performances where they're doing tricks simply to entertain the public. Now the public will be educated on, the life of orcas in the wild as well as in captivity. But on where they currently reside, SeaWorld has committed to expanding their tanks. We have always viewed tanks and swimming pools as poor habitats for these wide-ranging animals. Many years ago, we were involved in the effort with Keiko, the whale, who did go into a sea pen. But I think we got to remember Keiko was a wild-caught whale, and his circumstances were very different than SeaWorld's whales currently. SeaWorld has 29 orcas, 25 of them are captive-born, and so they've really spent their whole lives in captivity for decades. And so, we will continue to work with SeaWorld in trying to find better enclosures for them and larger space, but, it's a continual dialogue with them. But at this point, it's really not, at this stage today, practical to just instantly move them to sea pens. But we're committed to looking into these options.
So the long term is to actually no longer have orcas.
Yeah, long term, given the fact that they're no longer going to breed, this current population of 29 will be the last orcas in their care. We'll eventually see a day where SeaWorld houses no orcas, and they have committed that any new park that they may open in the future will not have orcas.
Nicole Paquette of the Humane Society, thank you so much for telling us about SeaWorld's new improvements in the care of orcas that they have.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
SeaWorld has been struggling with lower park attendance and public criticism since the release of the 2013 documentary Blackfish, which suggested that SeaWorld was not treating the orcas well. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. The passage of time is a common musical theme. It relates to all of us. Pink Floyd's legendary Dark Side of the Moon album devoted much of its outpouring to that subject, including a track titled Time. Now 43 years of time has passed since it was released. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins us with perspective as Dark Side of the Moon remains a huge fan favorite.
It's an ageless album, Jim. On March 10th, 1973, Harvest Records released Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd in the United States. And this was an album that the band had been working on for quite some time. They had developed the songs during live performances, and they performed an early version of the album in February 1972 at the Rainbow Theatre in London, a full year before the album was released.
And those fans lucky, and they didn't know.
Exactly. The critics raved about it. They said it was some of the best music Pink Floyd had ever made. The album itself was recorded from June 1972 to January 1973 at the famous Abbey Road Studios in London. And it was a unified piece of music. The songs flowed into each other using special sound effects and spoken word excerpts. It took a lot of the concepts and ideas that Pink Floyd had used in their earlier albums. This was their eighth album. Mm. But it was a much more unified piece of work than anything they'd done before. It looked at themes of greed, the passage of time, themes of mental illness, which was partly inspired by the mental breakdown of one of their founding members, Syd Barrett, in the late 60s. And people absolutely responded to it. Roger Waters, their bassist, said that he played the album for his wife, and she burst into tears at the end of it. So he says, right at that moment, I knew that we were going to find an audience. It certainly did. Dark Side of the Moon remained on the U.S. album charts for 741 total weeks from 1973 to 1988. And no other album has ever done this.
That's astounding.
It only was number one for 1 week, but it hung around the charts for 741 total weeks. The album sold an estimated 45 million copies worldwide. It's one of the best-selling albums of all time. And moreover, Dark Side of the Moon elevated Pink Floyd from a respected mid-level rock band to a global superstar act where they remained right up until the end of their career.
Technology also helped this album because we were so familiar with it, and by the time the 90s rolled around and CDs came out, we had almost a fresh listen to it.
Yeah, it was always a favorite among headphone listeners because of the depth of the production and the complexity of it all. FM radio stations of the 1970s would often play the entire record side as one track flowed into the next. In addition, it had a couple hit singles, Time, mm-hmm. Money, Everybody knew the music, and it seemed like every subset of music fans found something to like about it. Its appeal went right across the board, and it is 43 years old this week.
Speaking of numbers, we like our favorite number. That's the top 20 countdown. Ray McDonald is your host. Ray's also on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Follow him. Listen to him. Thanks for joining us, Ray.
Thank you, Jim.
The time is gone. The song is over. Thought I'd something more to say.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us anytime you like at our website, voanews.com. There you can stream our program. You can download it, too. Follow us on Twitter when you have a chance at VOA_IE is the handle to type in. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Come back when you can. Have a super day today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The strength of a nation depends on the success of all of its people. So any country hoping to grow and flourish must recognize the important contributions of women from all backgrounds and enable them to succeed in their work. Latin America has come a long way over the past two decades. Women serve in elected office, including as heads of state. They run businesses, large and small. They study and they teach. Yet they still face many obstacles. Perhaps most appalling is the widespread violence against women in the Americas, said U.S. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. Noting that between 17% and 53% of all women in Latin America have been victims of physical or sexual violence inflicted by their partners, Undersecretary Sewell said that many Latin American countries rank among the worst in the world for the number of women killed each year. To prevent violence against women, we must address imbalances in education, employment, and politics that reinforce a culture where women are valued less than men, where they are somehow seen as less worthy of equal respect, opportunity, and protection. Women who have suffered violence must have a clear pathway to justice, a system that consistently enforces the law and ensures a fair and responsive judicial process. The U.S. government works to prevent and respond to violence against women, integrate a gender perspective into our work, especially to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. In 2012, the United States developed a global strategy to tackle all forms of gender-based violence, which affects all countries around the world, including the United States. In Latin America, we assist indigenous and African descendant women to participate in local government and advocate against violence and discrimination. We train women entrepreneurs to reach new markets, and we partner with local law enforcement to train more female police officers, prosecutors, and judges. We do this not only because gender equality is inherently worthwhile, said Undersecretary Sewell. When you broaden participation and emphasize inclusion in business, in arts, and culture, in politics, it enriches us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
is for...